May it please the court. My name is Luke McFarland, registration number 33283. I represent the plaintiff in this case, Natalie Pedrine. Central to our appeal here today is this concept of opening the door. Put simply, a discussion of causation by plaintiff's treating doctor, Dr. Sasha, who was qualified to opine on causation, was disclosed as a causation expert, and has scientifically reliable experience in causation, does not open in the door to an unqualified expert discussing causation using studies that have already been determined to be scientifically unreliable and likely to cause confusion amongst the jury.
Mr. McFarland, but your own expert himself referred to studies of a similar ilk. So why doesn't that open the door?
First of all, I'm not sure that he did refer to studies of a similar ilk. What Dr. Sasha said was that, I believe the question was something along the lines of, the defendants have referred to this as a low-speed accident. Is it really possible for the plaintiff to suffer these injuries in a low-speed accident? And Dr. Sasha said, well, yes, it is, and here's why. And one thing that he said was, there's excellent data that supports it. He didn't reference any studies, and he certainly didn't reference the studies that Dr. Hamernick testified about, which, as I've mentioned, were already deemed by the court to be to have no scientific reliability and to show a great risk of confusion by the court. So that determination had already been made. That was made approximately 1 year before trial on plaintiff's motion. And Dr. Hamernick was prohibited from testifying that there was some sort of minimum threshold or minimum G-force or delta V required to cause injury. And that was the exact language the court used. No scientific reliability to that testimony and a great risk of confusion.
Mr. McFarland, what's the harm when the trial court only allowed the opposing expert to essentially just say there's contrary data? I mean, that's effectively what he said.
The harm is that the data that's contrary has already been determined to be to have no scientific reliability and to have a great risk of confusion. The other piece of the harm is the timing of the court's determination in that regard. Again, plaintiffs have been operating under the assumption for a full year that Dr. Hamernick would not be allowed to testify about these issues. As a result, plaintiff didn't hire a rebuttal expert to get up and explain to the jury, here's why those studies aren't scientifically reliable. And here's why courts, including a panel of this court in the Schultz case, and in which I believe Judge Roy was on the panel, have essentially agreed that these studies aren't admissible evidence in our cases. We didn't have the chance to hire an expert to do that. I didn't have a chance to consult with an expert to prepare a cross-examination of Dr. Hamernick on these issues, which again, as far as everybody in the case knew, were off limits. I didn't have a chance to even read the studies. They were handed to me right before his testimony. So it absolutely was harmful in that it prevented any meaningful cross-examination. It presented evidence to the jury again, which, and I think this is a very important point, it's the law of this case that that testimony was scientifically unreliable and likely to confuse the jury. The court made that determination a year before trial. The court never reversed that determination. The court never made findings or otherwise changed its mind to say, you know what, I've reconsidered and I no longer find these unreliable. That decision, that initial decision, was never appealed. So that remains the law of the case here today, that that testimony and that reference to those studies, all scientifically unreliable and likely to cause confusion to the jury.
The testimony here by Hamernick was very brief. I mean, he only said that the chances of an injury at less than 5 miles an hour is low.
Highly unlikely.
Isn't that just a drop in the bucket compared to apparent confusion on your client's part and her history after the accident of whether she'd been hurt or not or how badly she'd been hurt, representation she's made to third parties, all of which came in?
The answer is no, and here's why. First of all, the defendant spends a great deal of time talking about plaintiff's credibility. I believe those issues were fully addressed and disarmed, for lack of a better word, at trial. But importantly, we had a situation, because Dr. Burton had been stricken as a witness, where the only credible evidence in the case on causation came from Dr. Sasha. And you had Dr. Sasha explain, this is a treating provider, not a hired gun, no motive to lie, gets up and says, this accident caused Ms. Padreen's injuries, and here's why. At the very end of the day, you have Dr. Hamernick get on the stand, the last witness, the last thing the jury hears, and say, due to these scientific studies, which we've done with 1,000 people who voluntarily agree to be hit at 10 miles an hour, delta Vs of 10 miles an hour, it's highly unlikely that the plaintiff was injured in this accident. To me, that is just not only to make the statement, but to claim that it's backed up with science, and to leave the jury with the impression that it's backed up with science, is incredibly damning and incredibly harmful. Again, that's evidence that the court already determined would cause confusion. And again, that determination remains law of the case.
Well, help me understand that. Does the law of the case principle apply to an evidentiary ruling?
As opposed to
a substantive ruling like a motion to dismiss or motion for summary judgment?
I would certainly argue that it does, and the court made very specific findings that this type of testimony was unreliable and likely to cause harm. And importantly, and that was a year before trial, we relied on that fact, on that finding. So, and that finding was never disturbed or changed. So, again, it might be a different situation if the court said, "Look, I've reconsidered that determination, and my analysis of that issue, and I've reached a different conclusion." And that does happen, and that's within a trial court's discretion. That never happened here. The court never said these studies are reliable. And frankly, that would have presented an appellate issue for us if she had said that. Given the lack of reliability this data has, and the recognition by the district courts and by this court of the questionable nature of that data. If it is acceptable to your honors, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Sure.
Good morning. I'm Brad Ross Shannon, registration number 15220. I represent Tim Haller. In this case, the trial court properly and carefully exercised its discretion in determining that the plaintiff had opened the door and allowed very limited rebuttal testimony to evidence presented by the plaintiff, allowed limited testimony by Dr. Hamernick.
But opening the door only opens the door to admissible evidence. Well, and if the studies are as represented, that is, unreliable, and have been determined to be so, that doesn't mean that you can put in junk science.
What the court's pretrial order said was that there was going to be no testimony regarding the sufficiency or lack of sufficiency of G-forces necessary to cause the injury claimed. Dr. Sasha testified about the sufficiency of forces causing injury. The plaintiff's counsel asked Dr. Sasha specifically, are these injuries, is this whiplash injury consistent with
And he was endorsed for that purpose without objection, was he not?
He was endorsed as a medical causation expert. He was not endorsed as an expert regarding forces or engineering studies. And these studies, the ones that are referred to by Dr. Sasha and referred to by Dr. Hamernick, are studies in which engineers and medical doctors work together. And so they're kind of a hybrid type study. And when Dr. Sasha improperly said, well, there's excellent data, referring to studies that support the fact that you can get whiplash, you can get carpal tunnel, you can get disc pain from this type of accident, that opened the door. We had three bench conferences Before I asked any question, I approached the bench, so I was aware of the court's ruling, and we had three different bench conferences. And Judge Offler very carefully read the previous order. She referred to her notes about what Dr. Sasha had said and allowed very limited testimony on that specific issue.
You haven't answered my question. If the studies upon which this rebuttal testimony was given are unreliable, scientifically unreliable, and have been determined to be so, how does it come in? It can't come in as rebuttal evidence if it can't come in as direct evidence, can it?
Well, it can come in because it's the same type of evidence that the plaintiff presented. And what the order was by Judge Offler was that she determined that the evidence would maybe confuse the jury on G-forces and G-forces causing injury. Well, the plaintiff then introduced evidence regarding those studies. And so the issue that Joffler addressed in the pretrial order was essentially waived by the plaintiff when they introduced that evidence. So that's...
I appreciate the argument. I know what opening the door is, but my problem is the reliability of the evidence that you presented.
Well, but the order by Judge Offler was based on 702 and 403, and essentially... she determined that this type of evidence may be confusing, may be misleading. That was her determination, and that's why she kept it out. The plaintiff chose to get into that type of evidence, and so the playing field went like this, because the plaintiff is saying, well, there's data that says this type of evidence is reliable. G-forces can... this is a type of accident that causes injury. And so there's that literature on that side of the issue. Tilt the playing field, and the judge said, you know what, we've got to level that playing field. So you can talk very briefly about other studies that indicate otherwise.
Let me try to maybe ask, illuminate Judge Wright's question from it. Did the trial court make a specific finding that the studies on which Dr. Hammerlink intended to rely were scientifically unreliable?
Well, what the court indicated was that it reviewed a number of factors and found that essentially there was a great risk of confusion.
You're really not answering. Did the court, and this is a yes or no question, did the court make a specific finding that Dr. Hammernick's studies were scientifically unreliable?
Specifically, what the court said was a review of all factors shows no scientific reliability and a great risk of confusion with the theory that minimum G-forces are required to sustain specific injuries. Thus, no testimony can be given regarding the sufficiency or lack of sufficiency of G-forces necessary to cause the injury claimed.
Okay, so you would interpret, and I apologize if my question was kind of edgy. I mean, you would interpret that as equally applicable to any studies that say a certain minimum, you talk G-forces, but it's really speed. A certain minimum speed is sufficient per Dr. Sasha, or a certain speed is insufficient per Dr. Hammerlink. You would interpret that as equally applicable.
Yes.
Okay, I understand now. Thank you.
And the reason the issue wasn't raised with respect to Dr. Sasha is because he wasn't disclosed to give any testimony regarding studies about having a sufficiency to cause injury.
You were trial counsel.
Yes.
Did you object to Dr. Sasha's testimony when he referenced his study?
I'd have to review that. I believe I did.
Okay.
I believe I did. I'm not positive. If I didn't, I use that as the fact is that the testimony came in. And the plaintiff.
Okay, but I guess my point is if Sasha's testimony is barred by the pretrial order and you don't object to it, then aren't you stopped from making the opening the door argument? I mean, how can you have that both ways?
Well, I don't think so. I think I can make a tactical decision to not object to it and allow that testimony to come in, because I do think it opens the door. And in this case, it did open the door when Dr. Sasha testified about this excellent data that indicated that a minor accident can cause the type of injuries that the plaintiff was claiming. And the Supreme Court has found that when the plaintiff presents a misleading impression of the applicable literature, and as Judge Fox indicated, I mean, there's literature on virtually every issue on both sides of the fence, and the plaintiff was taking that order, and as I mentioned in my brief, using it as a sword, not as a shield. And that's when the judge allowed that very limited rebuttal testimony. And I think it's important to know that the court acted properly within its discretion by allowing a very general statement by Dr. Hamernick regarding the studies, similar to Dr. Sasha's, did not allow Dr. Hamernick to explain the credibility of those studies, and did not allow him to give any specific engineering opinion on the applicability of those studies to Ms. Pedrine in this case. Alternatively, even if you determined that was an error, that Dr. Hamernick should not have been allowed to give that those three answers to those limited questions, it's harmless error. There was overwhelming evidence in this case that this minor accident did not cause the claimed injuries and damages that Ms. Pedrine had. This case did not turn on one piece of evidence, on three questions during a 3 or 4 day trial. What it turned on was, again, the overwhelming evidence. This is a minor accident. My client's vehicle was not even repaired. There were significant credibility problems. Ms. Pedrine testified that she lied. She testified that when she applied for a CDL license to drive, as I point out, an 80,000-pound vehicle on the highways, that she lied, and that she acknowledged that she lied. And now she was saying, well, I'm not a liar because I'm now telling the truth. That was significant. She changed her story about how the accident occurred. She had claimed an ankle injury that happened 2 years after the accident. She claimed that was caused by the accident, yet there were three different stories, her testimony and two different medical records about how that occurred. And credibility in any case, and particularly a personal injury case in which there are no objective evidence of acute injury, as there were not in this case, are extremely important. Dr. Hamernick's testimony, three questions, was simply, I have studies, Dr. Sasha has studies. My studies say this, Dr. Sasha's studies say that. It was disputed testimony in which he provided no, was not able to provide any basis for the jury to conclude that his study was better than Dr. Sasha's studies. It was literally a drop in the bucket in this case. I think I know the court indicates that it's well aware of the facts, but it's important to know that in this case there was no medical testimony from the surgeons, the 12 surgeries that the plaintiff had in this case. The plaintiff appellant makes the argument that Dr. Sasha was the only expert to testify regarding causation. These cases don't turn on expert opinions. Causation, as the cross-examination that I have of doctors, causation is really, it's not a medical opinion. It's an opinion based on all the history, all the information that they have about whether this particular event caused the plaintiff's complaints. And Dr. Sasha acknowledged that his opinion on causation is based certainly if there's findings, but on whether findings were caused by a particular event is based on history.
Isn't his opinion based more on the plaintiff's medical history and on his experience with other people with similar histories reporting similar accidents, reporting injuries? Isn't that primarily how he goes about it?
I think so. But it's important that it's based primarily on what the plaintiff tells.
I understand that, yeah. But he treats the patient. He's treated other patients who have similar injuries, been involved in similar accidents, low-speed accidents, and he testifies based on that experience, primarily.
Sure.
Not on engineering studies, necessarily.
Although in this case, he offered that. But you're right. And the history, he was unaware of certain histories that the plaintiff had. He was unaware, for instance, she was claiming carpal tunnel. I think he had 4 surgeries for carpal tunnel. He was unaware that she had numbness and tingling symptoms consistent with carpal tunnel before the accident. He acknowledged that long-haul truckers, which is what Ms. Pedrine did, often had carpal tunnel problems. He also, I know one of you read the record in its entirety, he indicated that initially when I was questioning him that the degenerative changes and the arthritis in her neck had to be caused or were caused by macro trauma. So there's some injury, if somebody has that, it's caused by macro trauma. And then later in the cross-examination, when I pointed out, well, actually, at the time of the accident, she had those degenerative changes in arthritis, which would have indicated that they had been there for a long time before the accident. Then he acknowledged, okay, well, they're caused by micro trauma. So there was also things that Dr. Sasha said.
Down to a minute and a half, you haven't gotten to your cross appeal.
I appreciate that.
I want to raise a flag for you.
Yeah, thank you. One last point on this drop in the bucket. Dr. Sasha also talked about the fact that litigation is an important influence in somebody with complaints like Ms. Pedrine. So for the plaintiff to pick out one piece of evidence in all the overwhelming evidence, I think emphasized the fact that any error, and I don't think there was, but any error by Judge Offler was harmless. With respect to the cross appeal and our claim that the court improperly denied any recovery of costs and fees of Dr. Burton, the issue is whether it was reasonable for us to incur those expenses at the time that they were incurred. Plaintiff is arguing, you know what, it was unreasonable to pick Dr. Burton. The plaintiff is arguing, essentially trying to re-argue the motion for the Rule 35 examination. We selected Dr. Burton. Plaintiff opposed him. The plaintiff said, as a condition, we want the financial information. The judge said no. So we relied upon that order. We had the IME done, and then it was 9 or 10 months after the IME was completed and about a month or so before trial. I think we had some agreements in terms of when that could happen, but the plaintiff then subpoenaed Dr. Burton and asked for the financials.
Didn't the trial court leave some of the matters with respect to this Dr. Burton open? I mean, the plaintiff made a number of requests as conditions, one of which was the disclosure of this financial information. The court detailed some things, conditions that it imposed, and then was prepared to reserve the others for the normal course of production, which could include the financial records.
I don't recall that the court indicated it was reserving the others. I know the court did not order the production of financials at the time that it allowed the examination to go forward.
It neither denied nor granted that portion of the motion, so it effectively left that matter open, right?
Well, I guess I interpret it as that it denied it because the plaintiff was asking for those restrictions or those requirements for the IME to proceed.
But in any event, I mean, why does the trial court err by not rewarding either party because an expert disregards a court order? I mean, disregarding a court order is pretty serious. So why should the...
I'm not arguing that the court made the a proper decision in striking Dr. Burton as an expert. Really, the issue is whether when we incurred expenses to have Dr. Burton do the IME, number one, and then set him up for trial number two, were those reasonable at the time? And our position is because the court had not placed any requirement that he produce financials, and we had no idea that would happen, had no idea Dr. Burton would refuse to produce financials, but it was reasonable for us to then incur expenses once the court didn't make that a requirement as part of our Rule 35.
But there's plenty of authority out there that affirms trial courts who deny costs for experts when, you know, their testimony is rendered inadmissible, and here it was effectively rendered inadmissible by his own actions. So why shouldn't we follow that line of case?
Well, I think that's a decision for the trial court to look at all of the costs that we've asked for. But I think as a matter of law, that when we asked for the IME to be complete, at the very least, when the court had indicated it was not going to request financial information, there was no issue that Dr. Berman would be asked or ordered to produce the financial information and that he wouldn't do so. At the very least, those expenses were reasonably incurred at the time.
Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd ask the bailiff to add 2 minutes to the appellant's time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The first thing I'd like to address is this notion that the studies referenced by Dr. Sasha are the same studies or even the same type of studies as those discussed by Dr. Hamernick. The record reveals that that simply isn't the case. Again, Dr. Sasha didn't reference studies. He referenced excellent data.
What's the difference?
Well, I think that it's unclear from the testimony that was given because it was such a fleeting comment to say there's excellent data that supports it. And because Mr. Rothschild did not object to it and did not seek any inquiry into what's he talking about here? Is he talking about studies? Are those studies reliable? Are they medical studies? Are they engineering studies? We don't have a good sense of what Dr. Sasha is talking about, but we can infer from the context, and if this is on page 36 of the transcript of Dr. Sasha's testimony, right above where he says there's excellent data, he's talking, he says it's almost invariably the case, and the medical data supports that. Again, it doesn't really take an expert to know if you've got a neck injury, et cetera. And then just shortly thereafter, he says there's excellent data to support this. So,
but your preceding question to that is, or whoever trial counsel was, you know, again, can this type of whiplash injury be caused in an accident that is 8 miles an hour or less? And that's precisely the type of data that you were seeking to exclude the defendant's expert from addressing.
There's a key difference, and one, I don't think my question necessarily required him to talk about data. That wasn't my intent. But there's a difference between medical data and data that doctors accumulate in treating patients and that Dr. Sasha accumulated in his experience treating patients and in treating Ms. Pedrine that's different from these engineering studies that insurance companies put together with these volunteers who come in and have these mock studies. And again, we don't need to reopen why those are scientifically unreliable because it's already been determined in the case. There wasn't any discussion about what studies are these? Are these medical studies that medical doctors have performed, and what's the basis for them, and are they unreliable? So Mr. Rothschild talks about this tilting of the field. Well, that's just not the case. With Dr. Sasha's testimony, you have a medical doctor who's been endorsed as an expert witness on causation testifying about causation issues. With Dr. Hamernick, he is an expert who's not been
medical doctor or PhD in engineering.
He's a PhD. Who hasn't been endorsed to discuss causation issues, who's been explicitly barred from testifying about causation issues, and again relying on studies that we know. Now we have to speculate about it. We know that they're scientifically unreliable because that's what the court held. And just to clarify, I have looked again through this transcript, and Mr. Roshan did not object to Dr. Sasha's testimony.
Let me come back to the question, and I apologize, I don't have the transcript right in front of me, but you asked Dr. Sasha whether an accident of approximately 8 miles an hour could cause certain injury, correct?
Correct.
Why isn't that question improper under the trial court's pretrial order dealing with G-forces?
Because it's not seeking information about unreliable engineering studies. It's asking for his expert opinion as a medical doctor based on his experience and his understanding of the medicine.
Didn't the judge's pretrial order specifically exclude questions inquiring into the sufficiency or insufficiency of G-forces to cross?
What the trial court's order said is that testimony that there is a minimum threshold required for injury is junk science and isn't admissible. And so I think
So what's the difference between framing a question to Dr. Hammerink in terms of G-forces and you're framing a question to your expert in terms of miles per hour? Because it's just a mathematical calculation.
I don't think it is a mathematical calculation. I think it's, again, you're asking a medical doctor based on medical studies, which aren't subject to these same defects that our courts have found the engineering studies are subject to.
But the question that you're asking, Dr. Sasha, is really like a biomechanical issue. It's not a medical issue. It is an engineering-based question that is covered by the court's pretrial order.
I don't believe that it is, and it wasn't intended to be that question. What it was intended to ask, and what I think it fairly does ask, if you read the transcript, is do you see people who are injured in these accidents, who are injured in low-speed accidents?
But that's not what you asked, though.
Well, I asked if here's what I asked. Can this type of whiplash injury be caused in an accident that's 8 miles an hour or less? And he essentially says, yes, there's excellent data. It's basically how hard the patient's neck whips back and forth. But she says, he says, I honestly don't know what the speed of the injury was, but I can tell you from an objective standpoint, she had objective findings. She had a segmental dysfunction in her neck where there were segments you just couldn't move on exam, et cetera. So again, I interpret that he's basing that on his medical knowledge, that he sees people and the profession, generally the medical profession, sees people who come in with lower impact injuries and they have injuries. And what's really interesting is even Dr. Burton disagreed with Dr. Hammernick's testimony. Dr. Burton, who wasn't allowed to testify at trial, even he said that the plaintiff was injured in this accident, this low-speed accident. Now, of course, he said she was injured much, much less than we contend she was, but even he said she suffered injuries as a result of this accident. And that's why when you have doctors saying that this can happen and we see it happen, that's what lends the unreliability to these engineering studies that say the opposite. I did want to address just briefly this question of harmless error. Mr. Ross Shannon discussed the credibility issues. Again, I believe all those were addressed at trial. Ms. Pedrine volunteered on direct that she needed to get a job. She had something
We have no idea whether the jury accepted any of that, do we? I mean, accepted any of the explanation for what apparently were either misstatements or misrepresentations.
We don't know, but what we do know is that there was one expert who testified and should be testifying about causation. There was one expert who provided good testimony on causation. That was Dr. Sasha, and his credibility wasn't challenged until Dr. Hammernick got up and said that the scientific studies proved Dr. Sasha's a liar. And so regardless of plaintiff's credibility, Dr. Sasha's credibility was attacked. And again, this harmless error standard is, could a different result have been reached if not for the error? And here I think the answer to that question is certainly yes. If the jury hadn't been left with this impression that science says it's impossible to get hurt in these low-speed accidents, it's certainly plausible that they would have reached a different result. I would like to just briefly address Dr. Burton. I guess my hope, and I say this as an attorney who has no particular love or affiliation aside from some familial affiliations with the plaintiff's bar. I do 90% of my work on the defense side of commercial litigation cases. I find Dr. Burton's conduct, as outlined in the briefing, to be abhorrent, inventing new words. His repeated scoffing and thumbing his nose at orders of the court is reprehensible. And I think it's disingenuous for State Farm or Mr. Ross Shannon to say this blindsided them, given his history, which State Farm's been a part of. They knew when they hired him that he will not allow his credibility to fall victim to valid cross-examination into his bias. And so he hides it at every opportunity. Any court that orders him to produce that information, he gives up the fight in that case and gets stricken, but he lives to fight another day and to give 160 IMEs a year at least, making it millions of dollars off of the same justice system that he repeatedly thumbs his nose at, and I just find it reprehensible.
So it's difficult for you to believe that defense counsel was not aware of the possibility that he would not be permitted to testify at the time he hired him.
Well, I know as a matter of fact that he had to be aware of that, because I filed my motion. When he asked for an IME with Dr. Burton, I said, Dr. Burton has a history of refusing to provide this valid bias information, which is the only way to attack an expert like this. And it's a way that's permitted to attack an expert like this. And I filed a motion. I said, Your Honor, Dr. Burton has a known history of refusing to honor this discovery and ignoring court orders and then being stricken as a witness. And I don't want to spend my time. I don't want to spend my client's time sending him to an IME to be poked and prodded, only to have him be stricken as a witness at the end of the day. And that was all done ahead of time. And we do have the issue of the court's ruling, where the court makes absolutely no mention of what information might be required to be disclosed upon subpoena. She essentially punts on the issue and doesn't address it. Again, that wouldn't lead any reasonable person to say he's immune from bias discovery because the court ordered an IME. The court simply just didn't make it.
I'm going to have to declare.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for their briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much.